Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Awesome. Great to be here. I'm Jessica. I'm currently on the growth marketing team here at Zijino. We're basically a Amazon for lab supplies, a B2B procurement marketplace for the life sciences. I also do some content things outside of work, working with a few different seed and series A startups on content strategy, marketing, branding, communications. And then I also do some angel investing and scouting for different consumer and enterprise funds.
Super exciting, Jessica, and thanks so much for making time and joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Very diverse spectrum of responsibilities and projects that you are involved with. Very excited to talk a little bit further about each one of them. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Yeah, totally. So I was actually born in China and then came to the US later on in New Jersey, went to school at Harvard, studied applied math, a focus on economics and computer science. And career-wise, my experience started off in startups, worked with a couple of different startups, including Morning Brew on the growth front and Lux, this on-demand valet parking service on the operations front in Boston, and then spent some time in more traditional finance and public markets and investment banking, and then early stage venture to kind of bring it all together, worked with different seed and series A funds, including General Catalyst, Romulus Capital, Female Founders Fund, and later on Soma Capital, where I joined as an early hire and helped to build out the portfolio support, content, community, and of course, sourcing and diligence functions. And then most recently, around a year ago, came here to Zijino to help build out our go-to-market platforms.
Oh, that's very exciting and very diverse backgrounds. Very interesting on the content side, and also you've had your share of exposure, in the startup environment, which is very always fascinating to me as a founder, operator, entrepreneur of multiple startups myself. In the past, I've successfully failed most of them. I had some decent successes with a couple of them, but in general, the interest for me these days is on the angel investing side, where I try to help the founders, entrepreneurs, not only financially but also taking that experience that I had gone through for fundraising, growing, companies in general. So from that perspective, share with us any of the trends that you've been very excited about lately that you've been researching based on, you produce content for quite a few companies and publications. So I'm pretty sure you do a lot of research. So what are some of the things you're very excited about these days?
Yeah, totally. A couple of different things. I'll talk first about startups and areas for innovation, and then secondarily around just things happening in even the venture world as it relates to early stage and angel investing. So on the first front, a couple of things I'm personally excited about. One is the growth of social commerce in the US. I think people always talked about it for many, many years. It even was kind of a thing for a brief moment in 2012, 2013, around a decade ago, but kind of fizzled out and died out over the preceding years and sort of made a comeback in the past couple of years, especially since COVID started and TikTok blew up, et cetera. And so really excited about social commerce and what that could mean in the US. Obviously, we've seen it play out in China and other Asian, even emerging markets. But of course, the US is very different structurally in many ways. So it'll be exciting to sort of see how that plays out and how that intersects with the creator economy and influencers and new media. And so that's sort of the first thing. The second thing I'm generally always really excited about is infrastructure level businesses, not so much physical infrastructure, although that could certainly be one of the types of infrastructure, but more just this idea of focusing less around application layer software, of the software to software interactions instead. And so looking more at the layer beneath that and thinking about how companies can create modes through ubiquity instead of top-down enforced contracts. And so that's really exciting to me, API type businesses across any verticals. That's sort of the second thing. The third thing is community-driven approaches to health. I think behavioral health is obviously a challenging, complex topic, and many companies, researchers, physicians, et cetera, have taken many stabs at it. And of course, it's still a pretty unsolved problem in terms of how to get people to adopt healthier habits as it relates to weight loss or healthier eating or mental health. But I think that there's more community-driven approaches like the Nooms of the world, and I think other up-and-coming companies to be able to take on this space with a new angle. So really excited about that as well. So those are kind of the three main areas, innovation valuation and startup-wise, I'm excited about. In terms of kind of general trends around angel investing and early stage, I think it's really interesting these days with different angels, A, coming together to invest together, either through logistical means or literally through a community where they're kind of crowdsourcing deals together, looking at it together and being able to support the founders together. And so getting these community-driven approaches to venture will be really interesting to be able to get founders more diverse support all with one check or with one investment. And so that's sort of the first thing. Obviously, the second thing that everybody's really talking about is the rise of solo capitalists and just really the idea that anyone can create their own venture fund for better or worse, but I think it'll be ultimately for better after we reach that equilibrium point. And I think there's going to be more competition in the meanwhile, but I think that kind of drives better value for all parts of the ecosystem ultimately, starting with founders getting more value. And it's not just capital where you're able to differentiate. So that's super exciting to me as well. And the final thing I'll say too is what I've noticed, less of a trend, but more of a personal observation, and moving from traditional venture where that was my full-time day-to-day job to now angel investing, where venture is still a big part of my life, but obviously much more of a side thing. I'm not really fully attached to a fund as I used to be, but I think it's a really good forcing mechanism to force myself to think about how can I add value to founders outside of capital. And so that's super interesting and super exciting to me as well. And being able to not just chase the hottest deals in Silicon Valley, as I probably used to have to do when venture was my full-time job, but really focus on which founders do I have the best alignment with, the best rapport with, and the most interest in what they're building, and be able to build this super meaningful long-term friendship and be a meaningful part of their journey even after I switch jobs or make other shifts in my personal life. And so that's super exciting to me as well.
Yeah, those are definitely very interesting perspectives, which brings me, you couldn't have set me up any better for the next topic I want to discuss with you, is around the value add investor. Because, you know, I've been on both sides now, more actively on the investor side, and I see both perspectives. It's an interesting dynamic when entrepreneurs talk about the value they get out of angel investors or VCs in terms of not just the financial side, but the other spectrum from business growth. What are your perspectives on that? How do you make sure that you deliver the most value for the startups and the founders that you partner with? Any recommendations there?
Yeah, I think a couple of different things. I think obviously we'd all like to scale everything that we do, but I think when it comes to really being there for founders and being a value-added person and investor, it's almost impossible, maybe just super hard. I mean, there's some way that we have yet to figure out, but I think it's really hard to scale that. So I think it's really important to really prioritize and not try to meet, you know, like 100 companies a week or something like that, or invest in 1,000 companies. I think that's pretty unrealistic. Maybe you have the capital to do so, which is cool, but I think it's pretty unrealistic to have genuinely fulfilling and meaningful and value-added relationships with all of them or even most of them. And so I think there's a really big importance around focusing on depth over breadth and focusing on maybe not so few companies that you're not actually diversifying yourself enough, but few enough that you can actually focus your attention on most of them. And so I think that's sort of the first thing. The second thing I think is knowing the value of connecting people. I think a lot of times people often think value is in the form of advice. And of course, advice is great and you should certainly provide it if you have it. But I think oftentimes you're not always the best person to give advice because you might not have particular expertise in this bespoke situation or in this domain or in this sector or in this stage of company building. And so I think it's really valuable to be able to harness the power of your network and your network's network to be able to help the founder with the connections to the right people at the right time. So I think thoughtfully cultivating your own network is obviously you can't just go to your network the moment you need help. You need to really invest in it and cultivate it so that you're building non-transactional just in case and not just in time relationships, not just to help yourself, but also to help founders and anybody else you're trying to support. And so I think cultivating your network and being able to harness the power of your network and your network squared is really important. That's sort of the second thing. And the third thing is, feels a little bit emotional and a little bit touchy-feely, but I think it is really important to kind of be someone who really believes in them. And I think there's this meme, and I think it is pretty true around VCs kind of giving up on founders that don't seem to be performing well month to month or who are still in the journey of finding product market fit, which obviously, as everybody knows, is super challenging and can be prolonged even for the most ultimately successful companies and for the most brilliant founders. And a lot of it is luck and chance and timing and all those things you can't really predict or control ex ante. And so I think there's a lot of value in being someone who constantly believes in the founder, because people can really feel if you don't believe in them. Obviously, you can't just straight up say to them that you don't believe in them. But I think even if you stop responding to their messages or just stop paying them any mind, people can sort of sense, even through this remote world that we're all in, that you've kind of lost faith. And that's really sad, obviously, for them. And of course, isn't positive for your relationship with them, especially if they end up coming around and you want to do a follow-on round, or even just kind of to be a good person and a good supporter and further cultivate your reputation and brand in this very small world of Silicon Valley. And so I think it's really important to constantly stick by people, almost as you would friends who go through tough times or, you know, you have rough patches with. And so I think it's really important to just always be a believer, even if, and especially during the really hard times that companies have. And so I think that's sort of the third thing that's really valuable, and just kind of being someone they know they can text at any time with their hardest challenges and be really frank and really open with what they're struggling with and what's going wrong, instead of just having to paying a really rosy investor update email that a lot of founders feel pressured to do.
Well, that, you know, that's interesting. We can probably talk about the rest of the episode on this particular topic, because it's also my thoughts on that as an entrepreneur myself, and the founder, or I mean the investors or the VCs that have backed me previously. I had always had that framework of, it's all up to me as the founder and operator to derive the value that I want out of the investors that I have, because it's not necessarily an expectation that they're going to come to me with a toolbox or, you know, all of the resources and suggestions how to grow my company. Because, and so that's the framework that I love to, you know, to utilize, especially when I work with other entrepreneurs and founders when it comes to investment. So talk to us a little bit about building a quality deal flow, because as an angel investor, we don't necessarily always get access to great deals, because deal flow and access, completely two different animals that I had, you know, learned the hard way through the last 3-4 years actively investing into startups. What are your thoughts there? What are some of the recommendations that you can share that help you succeed in that space?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a couple of different things. I think one, in no particular order, one is to build really strong relationships with investors. You're going to be focused not so late, like growth stage or something that's interesting, but not as relevant. But focusing instead on building really strong relationships with seed, pre-seed, and Series A investors. Pre-seed and seed will likely be the spaces that angels mostly play in, sometimes Series A as well. But a lot of Series A investors, if they're doing their job well, which hopefully they are, will be getting in touch with, getting intros to, speaking with, or at least having some type of intro way into those pre-seed and seed founders, because of course they want to build those long-term relationships before they're able to invest or before their fund is able to invest. And so I think building really strong relationships with institutional investors, both leads and non-leads, since they all can be really collaborative with angels, is really valuable. So that's sort of the first thing. And they can share deal flow, but you can have a quarterly check-in call around what you're both seeing, and you're able to share deal flow with them as well. So it's really a give and a take. The second thing is building really strong relationships with other angels, especially angels who have domain or industry specific experience and spaces that maybe you don't know as much about, but are really excited about and hoping to do more in. So one thing that I did more tactically is go look at the cap tables of all the companies that I was invested in as an angel. And then when I was a full-time VC, built a lot of relationships with angels in a similar way by looking at the cap tables of my portfolio companies and just reaching out to those angels. I think obviously some of them won't respond, their inboxes are full, whatever it might be, but all of them will, because you have this natural starting point for conversation, this natural overlap, since you're both co-investors in a company together. And so I think that's sort of the second thing to do, is build really strong relationships with angels, starting with the companies that are in your portfolio as an angel or as a fund. And so that's sort of the second thing. The third thing is building really strong university partnerships. I know people have different thoughts around backing university founders or first-time founders. Obviously, it's helpful to have some work experience, have some entrepreneurship experience, but I think the university space is honestly for the taking. Of course, there's university-focused funds like Rough Draft, Dorm Room Fund, and Contrary, but I think at the end of the day, there isn't a dedicated fund focused on supporting these types of founders, and they do still need the support, even though they obviously have some ameliorant, if you will, of being in school, you know, having housing, food, et cetera, from that. But I think still, it's really great to be able to meet founders in the earliest parts of their journey, and school, university is a really great place to start. And so hosting office hours, hosting events, being a speaker, building really strong relationships. I'm on the advisory board of Harvard Ventures, for example, and did a lot of work with the Harvard Innovation Lab. And so I think it's really powerful to be able to stay connected to your, especially to your alma mater alumni community, probably the easiest wedge in, but also other schools as well. And so that's sort of the third part. The fourth thing I think is mentoring through different accelerators. I think, you know, if you mentor at 500 Startups, Techstars, Plug and Play, Accelerprise, all these really great groups, obviously you're able to meet companies. I mean, you have to, that's your job as a mentor, and you're able to meet them before they start fundraising. Usually, sometimes they'll have different timelines, but in general, they're not yet fundraising when you're meeting them, because you're meeting them to give them advice on other stuff or advice ahead of their fundraise. And so you're able to actually meet them, you know, live or at least via Zoom, and to be able to start off that relationship, not by like, oh, I want some allocation in your company, but rather through actually genuinely helping them. So that's sort of the fourth thing that I'd say that's really valuable. The fifth thing I think is joining angel groups, because these angel groups aren't just an email list, some of them are, but I think the ones where you're able to actually together hop on a Zoom with the founder is really valuable, because you're able to kind of crowdsource deal flow from all these really incredible operators, investors, and founders, and then also be able to look at deals and consider them and risks and opportunities together. And so that's sort of the fifth thing that I would recommend as well. And the sixth thing I think is actually just going through founders. So founders, somehow I'm not a founder, so I can't really share all the secrets, but I just feel like founders always know other founders, even founders who other VCs might not yet know or are still in the early days of getting to know. And so I think founders are a really great in and source of deal flow as well. Obviously, they're not going to be as predictable and as robust as VCs whose full-time job is to source founders, but I think it is still really valuable to be able to connect with founders and to be able to hear more about what other founders they're seeing, especially those founders who you're already invested in. That's a good way to start the conversation, and they can introduce you to other founders they're hanging out with or who they know. And so that's sort of a sixth thing I'd recommend. The seventh and final thing I think is just taking the time to write requests for startups. Obviously, you're going to get some spam emails or some odd emails that really aren't a fit at all, and you can, you know, just on a quick pass or just kind of ignore if that's what you prefer. But I think you will get some, obviously, signal to noise ratio is debatable, but I think you will get some interesting inbounds over time. And a lot of founders really appreciate people's thoughtfulness around space, especially as every fund gets more and more opportunistic and they feel like they're just going to chase every single hot deal. Founders really look for people who have actual industry experience or at least understanding and have a clear rationale for why they're investing in this space. And so I think it's really valuable to be able to show that through content or through well thought out, even cold emails to founders about, you know, why you really believe not just in hot deals, but, you know, in this particular space and what it is they're building. And I think ultimately just as humans, not even just founders, but as humans, fundamentally want to be understood and want to be valued. And so I think showing that value through showing your understanding and the time you took to understand these different spaces that founders are building in is really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that, and thanks for compartmentalizing in, you know, very concise way. I love the, you know, the 6-point model, because it's, you know, it's a combination of, you know, the art and the science as well, because there's no specific formula that you can prescribe to. It's at the end of the day, creating that personal framework that basically works for you. It fits your thesis. It fits the model that you're trying to subscribe to. So that's very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for that. As a content strategist, and you know, you've been with the Y Combinator. I see, you know, head of the content for multiple other startups and companies like that. Tell me a little bit about some of the content strategies, or more around the pitfalls and mistakes that a lot of the new entrepreneurs fall into, some of the common pitfalls or the traps that, you know, they underestimate, especially when they go to market or they try to build smaller communities, whatever the case may be. Talk to us a little bit from those common mistakes that you would recommend avoiding at the very early stages.
Yeah, so as it relates to content strategy, usually as part of brand building or thought leadership or go-to-market or marketing for early stage or really any stage companies, but a couple of different common mistakes. I think the first thing is writing content that's too high level in the sense of not being tactical enough. I think we've all seen a lot of content, I'm sure, that'll say things like, make sure you have enough cash to weather COVID, or make sure you build a differentiated brand, or make sure you hire great team members. But all those things, I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree with those points, but it's much more about how do you actually conserve enough cash, or how do you actually hire great team members, or how do you actually build a differentiated brand? And so I think it's really important to make sure that your content isn't just saying those three points and, you know, repeating it or reiterating it in some fashion and then ending with the conclusion, but really diving deep. Obviously, you can set the context with those things as headers or as topics you're about to discuss, but really diving into the tactical atomic unit of advice. So what actual questions did you ask founding engineers before you hire them? Or what actual groups or communities can you tap into to find potential founding engineers, if obviously that's the topic of your blog post as an example? And so I think getting to that atomic unit of advice and really asking yourself, in my target audience, will these people actually be able to read my blog post or read my ebook or read my whatever it is you're publishing and be able to actually do the thing within the next minute or the next hour without much external help or external resources? And so I think that's really important, getting to the atomic unit of advice and not staying too high level. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is targeting the wrong audience. So with Zagina, one thing that's really helpful for us in our content and go-to-market strategy is we used to target a lot of scientists with our content. And obviously scientists are really important to us, and we do ultimately want to build for them product-wise. And they are the day-to-day users of our platform, us being the Amazon for Lab scientists. But I think what we realize is that obviously scientists, as great as they are, usually don't have decision-making power when it comes to using or not using Zagina for their actual company. Sure, they can be an advocate, but ultimately we are more of a sales rather than product driven organization at this point in time. And so I think it's really important to consider, oh, it's the CEOs or it's the co-founders who A, have the decision-making power, and then B, are also the ones who are actually interested in going above and beyond their jobs to read content to stay ahead of the competition or to better themselves. I think for a lot of people, you know, being a scientist or being a lab manager is a great job, but it's still a job. Like, they kind of shut off their computers at 6 or 7 p.m. or 5 p.m. even, and just kind of go home and, you know, read Harry Potter, like whatever books they do for fun that are totally irrelevant to the job. And they might even prefer to read things that are irrelevant to the job to kind of clear their head before the next day. Whereas with founders, CEOs, C-suite people, their life is their job and vice versa. And so I think they're the ones who are always looking to go above and beyond, if you will, in their roles and be reading these types of content to better themselves. And so I think targeting people who are decision makers, as well as targeting people who are actually the ones looking for that type of content, is really important. So that's sort of the second thing. The third thing, I think, is having content that's too product oriented. A lot of times people think that content should be like, oh, you know, this is why our product is great, or this is why our product is what you need, or something like that. And obviously, you should write content that's relevant. You shouldn't be writing about automobiles if you're a biotech company, but I think ultimately it's a more long game than people think. And so I think it's less about, you know, getting people to buy right there and then. Obviously that'd be super cool if they did. And I'm not saying that'll never happen, but it's definitely not the most common thing. Even if you just think about things as a buyer yourself, I've rarely read a piece of content and immediately bought that person's product. And so I think it's really important to be able to play the long game and think about how can you address the pain points of your target demographic holistically, even if it doesn't directly map to a sale this minute. But if you're able to build trust and build credibility and be that go-to resource and have that brand recognition built up over time for your audience, that's really important. So I'd say that's sort of the third thing, is being really focused on helping people first and giving first versus trying to squeeze a sale out of them through your content. And so that's sort of the third thing. The fourth thing I'd say is not thinking clearly enough about whether content is the right way to reach your audience. Obviously, we're all reading a bunch of content these days, and in the tech world, we all pretty much like content. So that's great. But I think there are spaces or personas or types of people who don't like content, or maybe they, I wouldn't say they don't like it, but that's not their preferred way to spend their time. And they don't really actually consume much content. And maybe you better reach them through a billboard or through a phone call or through something else. And so I think it's really important to not just jump on the content bandwagon because everybody is doing it, everybody's talking about it. But I think it's really important to think about whether content is actually the best way, or one of the best ways, or a meaningful way at least, to reach your target audience. That's sort of the fourth thing. The fifth thing, I think, is being overly broad in terms of who you're going after. So it's not enough, for example, in Zagina's case, to be like, oh, we're targeting biotech companies. Let's just write a bunch of biotech company relevant content. Obviously, that is a starting point, but I think it's really important to truly understand the instincts and the human nature of the various personas and be crystal clear around what are the 3, 4, 5, probably not too many beyond that, key personas who are involved in the stakeholder and buying journey, whether they're ultimate users, like scientists in our case, whether they're decision makers, and what exactly they are as people. And so I think it's really important important to be able to be crystal clear about your personas and make sure that your content pillars really map to those personas. And you could even design your blog or your landing page to have a persona specific landing page for each of your key personas. They feel like they have a really bespoke experience when they go to your blog and look for your content. The sixth and final thing I think I'll say here is basically not exploring productized content. I think blog content is obviously the most common that we're all used to and we all think about. But I think you should also think about, you know, how can you actually deliver a concrete asset to your prospects? So not just like, here's an interesting blog with my thoughts that you all should read, even if it's a seemingly interesting title, but like, here's actually a checklist, or here's actually a template, or here's actually a calculator, or here's actually a list of questions that you should use for XYZ purpose, or here's an ebook, or here's something really concrete where they know, like, even if the language is weird in this blog post, or if it's not my style, I know I'm actually getting something literal through reading or clicking on this or entering my email address. And so I think thinking more about how to not just create blog posts with fancy titles, but thinking a lot more about how to deliver a concrete asset through your content is really valuable. And that'll get people more in the door more effectively.
Yeah, those are very definitely interesting strategies, especially when it comes to the go-to-market strategy, whatever the case may be, building that particular brand from the overall communication standpoint. There's so many different avenues in creating that plan and categorizing and prioritizing what are the different first steps that you're looking to make to get the message across. There's one thing, one question that I love that Keith Raboy always asked in his interviews. It goes within the lines of, if you were a product, how would you describe yourself in terms of the value that you provide to your customers? Yeah. Which is interesting framework, which a lot of times I subscribe to. I use that, especially when I work with other founders in terms of understanding the type of service or the value that they bring to their customers. So definitely very interesting frameworks here.
Yeah.
So when it comes to interviewing and really ability to attract talent, especially for founders of the startups, it's, you know, it's of utmost importance, right? Is for you to be able to showcase that you're capable of doing that. For me, it's a fascinating point, especially when I start working with the founders that I'm looking to invest in, picking up on certain indicators and signs that they're capable of doing that. How do you think about that? What are some of the, you know, strategies that really help you identify that this particular founder is capable of doing so? And what are some of the things that you do to help them succeed in that space, especially when it comes to surrounding yourself with, you know, the top performers that you need?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. I think a couple of different things. First, on the first part of your question around how to tell if someone really is a talent magnet, I think that's actually a criteria that a lot of VCs forget about, but I think is super crucial to the success of the company. That was something that actually my former boss at Soma really taught me about. And I think a lot more VCs are talking about these days of really seeing not only is this a good person or a fine person or even a good leader, but are they actually able to attract talent to their startup, especially because in those early days before they become a unicorn or a public company or whatever, which obviously takes a super long time if it happens at all, they're going to have to be probably paying lower salaries, or they don't have, you know, obviously the brand name of a FANG or, you know, big tech company like that. And so I think they really have to get creative and really have this kind of level of charisma, not to be too superficial, but I think that's really important. So I think in terms of tactically what I look for, I think a couple of different things. I think one is, are they actually plugged into communities where they're able to speak and connect directly and more personally with talent? So for example, if you went to a top school, they would be able to tap into and reach out to alums more easily. Or if they worked at a, you know, meaningfully large tech company, they're able to tap into the alumni or even existing employee networks there. Or maybe they're just like super connected. If you look on their LinkedIn, they're like connected. You have like, you know, 500 mutual connections or something, obviously TBD if they actually know them. But I think that's sort of a start as well. And so I think really seeing if this person is already plugged into circles with really talented people. And so I think that's kind of the first thing. I think the second thing is seeing if this person is a good salesperson, not just for the product and selling the product. Obviously that's important as well, but if they're really able to sell an opportunity, I think sometimes, like, you know, you're talking to a founder and you look at their deck and you think about it and you know, this is a good space, a good product. But when you talk to the founder, you don't get that same level of excitement as you would reading about it or looking through their deck. I think that's kind of a orange flag, if you will. Obviously they could just be having like a down day or they're tired or whatever. So definitely don't over index to it. But I think sort of seeing if they're actually able to generate excitement in you, because not that you're a potential hire, obviously you're a potential investor, but I think it's sort of similar of whether they're able to really generate this feeling of excitement and motivation and energy in someone they're talking to, even via Zoom. And so that's sort of the second thing that I would think about. And the third thing is if they're really able to be thoughtful around the culture. I think a lot of times people think culture is something you just think about when you're like 500 people or 200 people. And obviously that's important to think about at those points in time as well. But I think culture really starts with one person or two people, the two co-founders. And so I think if they can't build a compelling culture, a unique culture that they're able to talk about and be intentional about building, then it's probably not good. So I think people will maybe join, but it'll be hard for them to stay. And so I think that's sort of the third thing as well. And the fourth thing is seeing if this person is someone who you can really admire. So do they have a, you know, rags to riches story, for example, or do they have this insane level of resilience, or do they have this insane level of expertise in a particular space, even if they're young, even if they have had some challenges, failures, obstacles along the way, as we all do. And so I think people ultimately want to work for someone who they want to be, even if they don't want to like actually live their same life, literally, but I think they want to work for someone who's insanely resilient and insanely perseverant, or they want to work for someone who can, they can really learn from. And so I think that's really important as well. And so I think the final thing I'll say is looking for someone who's actually really selfless. I think a lot of times people think like founders have to be selfish because it's a dog eat dog world and they have to like be out there gunning for their company. And that's obviously important. Externally, they should be pretty competitive with their competitors, obviously. But I think internally, it's really important for them to put the company, put their team before themselves, and not just like, here's my thought and you're all going to adapt to it. But you know, obviously have an opinion, but really be open to changing themselves and changing their perspective based on new information. And so I think kind of finding someone who's at that intersection of contrarian, but data-driven is really important. And so that's sort of the final thing I'll say on that front. And to answer your other question around, you know, how to support founders in hiring, I think a couple of different things. I think one is like, just sometimes in my free time, I'll just like go on LinkedIn and basically search software engineer or search, you know, whatever, growth marketer, like whatever key terms, product manager, a salesperson, and build talent lists of people who I know or people who I could theoretically get an intro to for these various roles, and just organize them in a pretty chill spreadsheet, nothing super high tech or super fancy, but basically have these talent lists ready for when founders have asks around, oh, I'm looking for an engineer, I'm looking for a growth marketer, I'm looking for an X person. And so I think that's sort of one thing is just building talent lists in your free time. You know, if you have like a free, like 15, even 30 minutes, obviously that probably won't be enough all in all, but, you know, kind of building it up over time as you have these pockets of free time. So that's sort of the first thing. And the second thing is just doing events. Obviously COVID has put a hammer in that, but I think, you know, as the world opens up, as it soon will be, hopefully, you know, doing events where you bring together people who want to be founding engineers, or bring together people who want to be growth marketers or early growth marketers at early stage startups. Just bring together different people who are talented, who have this sort of entrepreneurial energy and aren't just satisfied with living it out for the rest of their life at a comfortable Google. And so I think doing events so that you really have this type of natural rapport with people, and you're also able to help all of these talented people connect with each other and feel special and, you know, get free food if nothing else. And so that's sort of the second thing of like doing events around talented people. I think the third thing is plugging into different communities, not just your own that you're building hopefully through step two, but other existing communities of, you know, engineering communities or marketing communities or, you know, programs like Reforge, and understanding, you know, who is really awesome in these spheres and being able to connect founders to these communities when they're looking to hire the appropriate or corresponding people. And so that's sort of the third thing is connecting with these existing talent infrastructure communities. The fourth thing I think is connecting with people sort of similarly who have really good jobs newsletters and newsletters where they're able to share jobs. And so you're able to actively help founders get their jobs included in these very high traffic, high reach newsletters and put their brand out there. So that's sort of the fourth thing as well. The fifth thing I think is getting really good at writing job descriptions. I think people often think like job descriptions are really cut and dry, and obviously a lot of them are, and that's actually not good. And so I think it's really important to kind of, even like when you're looking at job descriptions yourself, either just like for fun, maybe for whatever reason, or like, you know, for your own job, maybe you're doing a job search. I think it's really important to kind of think critically of like, what did this job posting do well and what it did not do well, and kind of gather a book, if you will, or at least a list of lessons, and be able to help founders actually craft really compelling job posts, both the actual post page itself, but also the way in which they market it on social media. And so I think that's really important and something you can really tactically help them with as well.
Yeah, it's interviewing and recruiting. It's I operated in the space for a few years and still do with other staffing companies. And I'm actually part of an organization where we build a technology for staffing firms. And it always fascinates me the whole human element because it's especially when it comes to interviewing, it's such a difficult space to nail down. It's an ongoing journey from learning standpoint that it's a combination of art and the science as well, because and I'm yet to see someone who is really, really good at interviewing. It's one space that I think it's very hard to master because it's such a unique space in terms of short period of time to be able to make that assessment and really evaluate if it's also a fit for them in terms of, are you the type of leader that they want to be associated with? Are you the type of environment and the culture that you're trying to build? So yeah, those types of topics really fascinate me, as especially collaborating with founders and entrepreneurs, how they go about that. One phrase that really stands out to me is in the famous book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things from Ben Horowitz, where he talks about hiring for strength versus lack of weakness, because it's so simple, but oftentimes overlooked when you're interviewing. And I catch myself a lot of times like that as well, where you're almost looking for that tolerance when it comes to, those are the weaknesses that I can tolerate in that particular individual. And if so, it's probably a good match. So that's the trap that we all fall into, I think. At least I find myself there. And Jessica, last segment of the each episode, I love focusing on your sources for learning, your sources for self-actualization. What is your content diet is looking like with so much information being thrown at us in all different directions? Share with us your sources, but at the same time, how do you go about being selective with what you let your mind be exposed to?
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think something that people don't often think enough about. I think for me, just more tactically and then sort of high level, I'll get into that as well. But I think tactically, I like having newsletters just delivered to my inbox. I think it's a little hard to kind of remember to go to particular blogs like once a week or once every couple of days. And so basically subscribing, I think really to no more than like five or six newsletters, assuming each of them get sent like a couple of times a week. Because I think it's really important to be able to spend time with the content. And obviously I have some like news newsletters, which obviously come daily. I think it's important to stay up to date with the news. But I think in terms of the actual in-depth dives, and I think I also kind of think about what are the three most relevant topics for me. Kind of getting to your other question about how to be selective. I think a lot of times people are like, oh, this is a cool topic, like Bitcoin, everyone's talking about it. I should probably like know about it. And they start like reading a bunch of stuff about it. And obviously there's probably no real harm in that. But I think it's really important to also think about, is it the best use of your time or the best use of your headspace? Because while it's a cool, interesting, relevant topic, it might not actually be super relevant, or it could be really relevant, but you need to know. And so I think kind of thinking about here are the three most relevant things that are kind of a combination of your work and your goals and your interests. And so I think listing out very, being really clear, not like general, like, oh, tech or startups and everything is that, but being really crystal clear around here are the three main priorities as defined by my needs at work, as defined by my interests, as defined by my future goals for the next job or for this job moving forward. And so I think that's sort of one way to kind of think about how to be selective around what you subscribe to. I think a second thing too is like sometimes, you hear really great things about a podcast from your friends or from whoever, or great things about a blog, and you subscribe or you listen and you realize that actually didn't learn too much from it. I think sometimes people doubt themselves, like, oh, maybe it was just like an off episode, or maybe like I just didn't listen carefully enough, or maybe I'm judging it differently. But I think it's important to have sort of like a 2-3 strike rule, where like if you listen to three episodes and none of them are really resonating with you or adding the value that you want, then just don't listen to it anymore. Obviously, that seems a little harsh, but I think it's really important, just given the plethora of information out there, to really focus on the ones that are aligned with you, because your friends could have found a lot of value in it because of their unique situations and understandings that are really different from yours. And so I think take recommendations from people, but also have that kind of 2-3 strike rule when you discover a new newsletter or a new podcast. And so I think that's sort of a second thing to kind of keep in mind as well. And I think the third thing too is like really understanding like the balance. So sometimes you need like those super short, snappy newsletters just like tell you what the heck is going on in the world. And then you also need those more in-depth dives. And so I think making sure you're enriching your brain with kind of a diverse stack, that's not good to just solely do short, snappy news. It's not good to solely just do deep dives. You probably don't have the, you know, time for that, frankly. And so I think that's super important as well, to make sure you have a good balance and a good diversity. And the final thing I'll say is sort of like make sure, kind of going back to that, you know, three goals or three priorities for you, make sure you're reevaluating that. Cause I found like throughout the year, I've realized like, actually this newsletter isn't really bringing me to my goals. My goals have changed, or my role has changed, or my interests have changed, or the world has changed. And so I think that's really important to kind of be able to reconsider and make time and space for yourself to reevaluate that as well. The final thing I'll say is like, find different ways to consume information in the way you don't have to just like sit down and like read a book for like 2 hours. Nobody really has that time within a given day. And so I think it's really important to, for example, if you go on a run every morning and go to the gym, instead of listening to music, maybe, you know, do that sometimes, or if like you really need to like wake up or something. But I think generally, you know, try to listen to podcasts instead. Or maybe if you're, you know, waiting for your coffee at Starbucks or whatever, like, you know, read a newsletter or just scroll through one on your phone really quick. Or maybe you're driving to the grocery store instead of like listening to the radio, which is sort of a hit or miss, like listen to a podcast or listen to an audiobook. Or if you're like even just brushing your teeth, you can listen to an audiobook. And so I think kind of thinking about different ways to learn throughout the day, not just in like, oh, I have to carve out time. Because, you know, obviously, as we all know, life gets in the way, and we probably never really get to that. And so I think that's really important as well. Maybe the final thing I'll say sort of in that vein as well. Sometimes people are like, oh, you know, I'm just like tired. Like, I don't really want to do anything. Like, don't want to look at a screen. Let me just go watch Netflix or like just stare at the ceiling or something. But I think kind of like looking towards books instead of sort of a helpful way. I think we're always so bombarded by like Zoom screens and email and text messages. We're always like so plugged in and so reactionary and focused on the urgent stuff, but not really the important stuff. And I think reading is one of those non-urgent but important things, especially if it is the right book. And so I think kind of like, you know, building, reading books without technology, not even like on your phone or something, not even like reading a new on your phone, but like a true physical book is really special. And I think something that's been really helpful for me for learning as well.
Those are great recommendations. I definitely, you know, it resonates on so many levels. Yeah. Because it's, you create your own bubble, right? That yeah. you want to live in. And at the same time, you want to be extremely selective and have that almost muscle memory to be able to stick to that. Because a lot of times I catch myself, even I just, you know, I look at the clock and then just, you know, look back and then, oh, for the past hour, what did I do? So yeah. I'm just going down to these like rabbit holes where yeah. you didn't even intend to. It's, you know, those are very dangerous zones to fall into. Jessica, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I personally learned quite a bit. I love your very concise, compartmentalized, and very specific responses, which I think is very difficult to accomplish, especially when you hear very broad and loaded questions that we covered. So I thought you did an outstanding job there. What I love doing with all of my guests is do a follow-up episode in about a year to see how much of change transpired. Revisit the conversation from a year ago and see everything that we've talked about still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you.
Yeah, I love that. Really excited for that as well. And it was super great to chat. Loved your questions and appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.